Our next guest looked back at 100 years of American experience with the disease diabetes, what she started out looking for and what she found and then ended up pursuing in her new book. They're just not the same things. She challenges the framework of thinking about this disease and something that we can understand as simply affecting one race or one group of people disproportionately. There have been historically a variety of reasons to chalk up having diabetes to differences among races, but biology is not the whole story, and here to tell us about it is Arlene Marcia Tuckman. She's the Nelson O. Tyrone Jr. Professor of History and former director of the Center for Medicine, Health, and Society at Vanderbilt University. And we should note she received her PhD from the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and her latest book is called Diabetes, A History of Race and Disease. Arlene, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm very happy to be here.
We're happy to have you here. We do want to start way at the beginning, though, because you actually set out to tell more of the story of type 2 diabetes, and then you didn't end up writing that book. Why didn't it work?
Well, I realized at one point while I was doing my research that they didn't distinguish between type 1 and type 2 diabetes. Officially, they didn't make the distinction until the late 1970s. Probably a few decades before, there was a lot of discussion that they might be two different kinds of disease. But certainly in the time that I began in the late 19th century and for the first half of the 20th, they believed that diabetes was one disease. They certainly were aware that if you developed it when you were young, your prognosis was much worse. You would probably die within a few years. And if you developed it when you were middle-aged or elderly, that you had a much better prognosis. But they thought of it as one disease. So that I ended up realizing that it would be anachronistic for me to think that I was writing a book of type 2, just about type 2 diabetes.
What inspired you in the first place? Because your other books, they're not about diabetes.
Correct. Well, as an historian of medicine, I had long been interested in the history of disease. And the deciding factor was when my dad moved to Nashville in 2002. He had been diagnosed with diabetes in the 1980s when he was 65. And interestingly, he was misdiagnosed. They assumed he had type 2 diabetes. He was 65, and age is a risk factor. He was short and rather overweight. And so they assumed that he had type 2 diabetes. It took about a year and a different physician until they realized that he had a rarer form of diabetes called LADA, or latent autoimmune diabetes of adulthood, which has similarities to type 1. So his body did not produce any insulin. And from that point, for the remaining 28 years of his life, he injected insulin 4 times a day.
You used the word assumed there, that people assumed, physicians assumed that this was his disease. And your book really is about all of the assumptions that we make when we think about diabetes and who it affects.
Yes, absolutely. You know, the irony didn't escape me that had my dad been diagnosed 100 years earlier, it would have seemed perfectly natural that my dad had diabetes because we're Jewish, and the assumption in the late 19th century and well into the 20th century was that the population that was most at risk of developing diabetes was white people in general and Jews in particular. There was even a belief that people of who were African American, Native American, that they had an immunity.
And you take different pieces of your book to try to tackle this idea that certain people have immunity or certain people are more predisposed simply by genetics, because it's not just about genetics; it goes beyond our genetic makeup.
Yes, absolutely. So, I mean, even before genes were actually discovered, right, they're still talking about biological traits. So one of the arguments in my book is that as researchers noticed that diabetes was distributed unevenly among different populations that they viewed as races, when they saw these health disparities, that consistently they explained these disparities by pointing either to the biology or genetics or to the behaviors of the particular racial groups. And that shifted over the course of the 20th century from believing that, as I mentioned, that whites and particularly Jews were most likely to develop diabetes, to viewing Native Americans as most susceptible, African Americans, and then Hispanic Americans. And the explanations always focused on the biology and behavior of those populations.
And why are you finding that's not true?
Well, I want to give my historical actors some credit. There was always a minority of voices who argued that that one had to pay attention to the living conditions, whether it was poverty or discrimination. So Jews who and Jewish physicians who actually accepted that they had a higher rate of diabetes claimed that it was because of the millennia of discrimination that they had been subjected to that made their nervous system somewhat unstable and made them susceptible to nervous diseases. What's really important about this is that nervous diseases were considered to be diseases of civilization, that only those who were most advanced had the most developed nervous system. And the downside of that is that it it made it more likely that you would develop a nervous disease.
Arlene Tuckman has written a book about diabetes and the factors that play roles in whose bodies actually develop this disease. And there's room for you in this conversation here on Central Time. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. What changes would you like to see in how we think about disease and race as a culture or as a community? What questions do you have? 1-800-642-1234 is the number to call. Arlene, a lot of your writing deals with race and really racism. So yes. How did that become intertwined with diabetes?
So the explanations, as I mentioned, that always looked to racial traits and to behaviors that were linked with particular races, that always masked what was going on around the communities that were suffering so much. So what interests me is how people are living in particular conditions that make them sick. And yet when the medical community or the public health community, but also popular writers, so in newspapers and magazines, when they try and explain why a particular population had a high rate, they are ignoring all of the factors that are products of racism, and they are attributing the high disease rates to the biology and behaviors of the population.
Then how much can we attribute to doctors, to political leaders, white or non-white Americans using certain language when thinking or talking about diabetes?
How much can we,
I guess, for lack of a better word, how much can we blame them? I mean, how much of this is a part, how much of it, you know, matters the way that we talk about it, you know, when we have facts?
Yeah. So I really would like to get away from the language of blame because I want to get away from what really predominates today, but has always been part of the way that we look at disease, and I would say especially diabetes, and that is our inclination to blame people for being sick. So maybe what I would say is that physicians are a part of our culture, and they always have been. They are not immune from the kinds of language and representations that circulate through our society. So we have to stop thinking that by virtue of something being medical or even having a disease label, that it is neutral. In fact, diseases really are sites where false claims about a population's racial makeup get absorbed and they get reproduced. So I think in terms of what goes on within the clinical encounter, it would be really wonderful if medical schools would do some anti-racism training. I'm sure some are. And just ramp it up. We all heard recently about the Ohio state senator who lost his job as an emergency room physician because he blamed high COVID rates among African American people on the fact that they don't wash their hands enough. And that kind of statement, we know that he spoke it out loud, but that others are also thinking this, and we have to tackle that.
Yeah. Arlene, thank you for that framing, that way to think about it. We're talking with Arlene Tuckman. She's written a book about diabetes and how race and really racism play a role in whose bodies have to cope with this disease. And there's a line for you at 800-642-1234. Do you have a connection with this history of diabetes? Do you have the disease? When were you diagnosed and what has your experience been like? We want to bring you into this conversation and you can join us at 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Our conversation continues here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. Thanks for joining us on Central Time. We're talking about diabetes and not just how our genes influence whether we'll deal with the disease, but also how race and class and other circumstances factor into our risk. You're listening to the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Boltina. Arlene Tuckman is our guest, and we're taking your questions at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have for our guest who studied the history of this disease? You can give us a call at 800-642-1234. And we'll go ahead now and take a caller. Anne from Waukesha is on the line and wants to join our conversation. Hi, Anne.
Hi, you guys. Thank you for having this conversation. I have history of diabetes and have been insulin dependent since for the last, I would say, 5 years. I have a father who had it, a great grandfather who died of Bright's disease, which is what they called, I guess, the kidney disease. And I'm really struggling with the cost right now of treating the disease. I know historically it couldn't be treated, but now it can be treated, but the expense of insulin is extraordinary. I wonder if you could comment on that.
And thank you so much for bringing up treatment and the cost of managing this. And, Arlene, what do you think here?
Yeah. There really isn't a treatment for diabetes, as I'm sure you know. What we have developed over time are better and better ways of managing the disease and managing the highs and the lows. And you're absolutely right. The cost of treatment is horrendous. And the more advanced technologies that we have are like pumps. They're just out of reach for individuals who are not very comfortable financially. And I think this just points to how much we need to have an overhaul of our healthcare system and to have universal care and to healthcare and to be able to negotiate reasonable drug prices with the pharmaceutical companies.
Because when we're talking about people who can't afford the different ways that you manage diabetes, we're talking about class, which also plays into every piece of the history of what we know about diabetes.
Yes, absolutely. And Poverty is a big part of how diabetes has been reimagined. What I would like to add to this is that people who are living in poverty, no matter what their skin color, are with many of the same issues. But when we're talking about populations of color, we have to also pay attention to the physiological, the biological effects of racism. And that when you are confronted in every aspect of your life with racist practices and racist policies and racist beliefs, you often develop chronic stress. And we know that chronic stress produces, dumps more cortisol into your system, and this increases your risk of developing chronic diseases. So, I grew up talking about the difference between nature and nurture, but research that demonstrates that our environment can directly alter our biological, our physiological state, then that just explodes that that distinction.
We are talking with Arlene Tuckman, who's written a book about diabetes and the factors that play into who gets it and how we manage it. And there's room for you in this conversation at 800-642-1234. James from Appleton wants to join us. Hi, James.
Hey, how are you?
Good, thanks. What's on your mind?
Well, I got diabetes about a year ago, type 2. And when I was in the ER being diagnosed, the emergency room doctor was really pushing for insulin and that I should be on insulin the rest of my life. Having read a book on diabetes and having a mother who was a diabetic, I chose diet and exercise, and now 80 pounds down and a year later, I don't take any pills and I just manage it with diet and exercise, and it can be done. You don't have to be reliant on the medicine or the pills if you're willing to do what needs to be done to get it, to get it under control.
Yeah, James, congratulations on that work for sure. It worked for James. But Arlene, James talks about a significant weight loss, and that brings us back to the idea, the assumptions about obesity and diabetes. And there's a medical connection, but it's not always what we think.
Yeah. Also, congratulations. That's really wonderful news. And what I would like to say about this is that we do have a way of thinking about diabetes as a diabetes over which people have choices, around which people have choices, and that if they just decide to exercise and eat well, then they can lose weight and no longer have the symptoms of diabetes. But that whole frame assumes that you have the resources to do that. It assumes that you have enough control over your daily activities, that you're not trying to manage how to live on unemployment or how to live on food stamps. It is developed within a framework of people being able to get to supermarkets and buy healthy foods. And so I actually think that this language of choosing is what feeds into a language of blaming. And what I would really prefer to see is that we pay attention to all of the constraints that people are struggling with that make it difficult for them to make the kinds of choices that we know can improve our health. So it's just not the same when you're living in deep poverty as when you have access to resources.
And this relates somewhat to Charlie called in to ask if there's a difference in the way diabetes is managed in other countries that don't have the racial problems that America does. Arlene?
I'm not an expert on that. Certainly in other countries, and I would say what's more important is whether there's universal health care, and then also what kind of attention and what kind of financial investment is placed in public health. But there are lots of other countries where they may not have the racial problems, but they certainly have stark class differences.
Mm. What do we need to do then to to free ourselves from the assumptions that we've pointed out, to really push ourselves to think about this differently and break this chain of race-related diagnosis of diabetes?
Well, I think we have to change how we think about disease causation. We have to stop blaming, and we need to do what we can to create conditions that help people make healthy choices. I don't know if I have time to give an example here,
sure.
But I would like to say that when I think about the parallels to COVID-19, we have a long history of explaining health disparities by blaming particular racial traits. We also have a long history of counter arguments. So where small groups would try to draw attention to discrimination and to poverty. But that latter argument has had a really hard time gaining traction. There were moments like during the civil rights movement and the war on poverty, but then the Reagan era came and all of that was dismantled. And I'd say we're at a similar crossroads today. The question is, what will happen post-COVID? And I just want to give one example of how racist beliefs become part of how we normalize our conversation around COVID-19.
Yeah, we have about 20 seconds, Arlene. Go ahead.
Okay. We have to stop blaming high rates of COVID-19 on high rates of diabetes and other comorbidities. All of them stem from the same environmental and social conditions that make people sick.
Thank you for that. Arlene, we've really appreciated this conversation. Thanks for your time.
You're welcome. I was glad to be here.
Arlene Marcia Tuckman is a professor of history at Vanderbilt University. Her new book out this month is called Diabetes: A History of Race and Disease.